It's time now for the Sports Objective Podcast. No talking heads, just guys who love sports. Here's Dave Richmond.
Welcome into the Sports Objective here as we're broadcasting live on Facebook Live and, of course, our YouTube channel. And Bubba and Kyle, we've got a great big show tonight.
Absolutely, Dave. So much talk going on. Will we have a college football season if there is one? When will that be? This guy spent, nearly four decades in the college football profession. Now he's coaching high school ball down in Athens, Georgia. Welcome into the show, former Virginia Tech OC and Louisiana head coach, Richie Bussell.
Well, I appreciate you having me on. I'm sorry I had such trouble getting back to you, but I've kind of enjoyed doing this high school stuff a little bit because I don't teach over there, so I just go over there and help them out a little bit, and I didn't like school the first time I went through it, so I'm just over there just kind of helping them and showing up when practice starts, so it's all good.
Yes, it is, Coach. Thank you so much for coming on with us, and wanted to have you on. Certainly one of the things that's been very surreal is this whole experience. How about for you personally? How are things in Georgia?
Well, it's about the same way. I mean, we're kind of one of these, I guess, early states that tried opening up. But as far as, you know, the everyday, you know, we're still staying at home. I went to pick up some food last night and because some of those restaurants did open here in Athens. And, you know, they had said they had hardly no business. And our, you know, obviously, you know, I'm talking to our kid, you know, I think we're in the last week of school as far as school goes here. So I've talked to some of my quarterbacks and met with a quarterback that's going, that I had last year, is going to USC. And so, you know, but I kind of hate not, I can't play golf either. That's the real bad problem.
you got a quarterback going to Southern Cal. I'm assuming he wants some games for you.
Yep, he was in a wing tee offense last year, and then we went over. I was at another school last year helping them, but I went over and we kind of completely changed the offense. And he ended up being the offensive player of the year and threw 36 touchdowns, something like that. And a little bit different than the wing tee, but you know, he's actually had several offers and so forth. But so he's really had just last year to prove himself. So, yeah. And that's what I hate to see for some of these other, these kids coming up this year that, you know, these rising seniors are, you know, are they going to have a chance to do the same thing? It's crazy.
Coach, in the open, I was talking about your experience and just background in the college game, 35 years or so, 14 of those on Frank Beamer's staff, two different stints in Blacksburg. But before we dive into all of that, I know you were a wide receiver at Clemson back in the mid-70s. So just talk about your background in the game as far as going back to high school and your childhood, and then what led you to Clemson?
Well, I was very fortunate. I didn't play football. I mean, I played all the sports, but I happened to have a father at that time that thought football had too many injuries and so forth. So I never played the junior high ball and all that. I didn't play until I was in the 10th grade. And I actually got to play for John McKissick at Somerville High School. He was my high school coach, who is the winningest coach ever in high school football. I know you guys have probably talked about him. He just passed away. I think it was Thanksgiving, I think, something like that. But, you know, so I played for him, and he was a great, great teacher. And I also got to see him this summer for several hours. And then went on to Clemson, and I was going to play. My dad was a professional baseball player. He was actually the head baseball coach at the Baptist College at that time. I think he's Charleston Southern now. But so I always thought I was kind of heading to baseball, but I just love playing. I just love playing football. And I played, you know, tried to play a little baseball as a freshman, but it was just too much for me because I wasn't the best student in the world. And to go through a football season and then try to go to baseball and miss class, it was tough. So I just, you know, end up just playing football, and obviously, you know, got a break, and I knew I wanted to coach, and got a break, and as being a graduate assistant at Clemson. So that's kind of where it all started.
How is it for you, you know, a guy who's been through the coaching ranks? You've coached at, you know, at Virginia Tech, at Lafayette, at other stops along the way, and now you're a high school coach. But just, you know, as an alumni or a fan's perspective, when your university is successful, you're proud. Is it different for a coach, being you've coached so many different places? are you still just as proud of Clemson for doing the things they're doing in football right now? Is it the same way as a regular fan?
You know, probably not as much as a regular fan, but on kind of a different kind of level of where we were at that time, knowing, you know, the support for the program and the kind of facilities. You know, so I'm really proud of what they've done. There's no question about it. I know the fans, you know, kind of get overboard. I'll be honest with you, I'm not a good fan, so I watch the game in a different light.
Right.
But I'm really proud. They've really Dabo's done a tremendous job.
Coach, you're talking about how you got your start as a GA at Clemson. Your first, I guess, paid gig was, what, in 79 at Gardner-Webb as a defensive coordinator, and that's kind of ironic because you got that start on the defensive side of the ball, and that, I guess that's the only year that you've spent on the defensive side of the ball, right?
Well, I did have another 2 years, but, you know, what was great, you know, I worked under Charlie Pell at Clemson. So – and he told me right off the bat, he had been the defensive coordinator, now he's the head coach. He said, I'm going to do something for you, because I thought I was going to get to coach receivers and coach running back, something I knew. And he says, I'm going to put you on defense. You know, if you're going to be a college coach or a high school coach or whatever, you need to learn some of the other side of the ball. So I got a little bit nervous about that, but I was able to work with Mickey Andrews, who is ended up being at Florida State so long. So I all of a sudden I started coaching them guys running backwards, and after being a receiver like that, so I learned a tremendous amount from that defensive staff, and and worked with Mickey for 2 years, great teacher that he was for me, and got my first chance to go to Gardner-Webb and be the DC and a defensive back coach. And after my first year there, Ed Emery called me to East Carolina, where I coached the defensive backs for 2 years, and then moved back over to the offensive side of the ball. But it was a great move for me professionally to learn a lot about what was on the other side.
Right, and say kind of a follow up to that. I've read Bill Walsh's book, and that's what he was talking about. Most people think of him, of course, with the West Coast offense,
right?
And that side of the ball, but I believe it was at Cal he was actually a defensive coordinator.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of coaches that have done that. When you look up guys' bios and so forth, and, there's a lot of guys that were different position coaches on the other side of the ball. But, Coach Pell told me straight up, I'm doing this for you. He said, I think you'll be a good football coach, all that stuff. But I was nervous about it because, like I said, I hadn't been on that side. So, but it was great. But there's been a lot of coaches do that. I think a lot of successful head coaches have done that.
So, just talk about. I saw 1983 and the Arizona Wranglers. Talk about that experience before you got back into college coaching at Northeast Louisiana, which is now UL Monroe.
Right. That was the USFL, the United States Football League, and that was that summer league that was coming up. That was after the I can't remember the name of the other league, but and they were going to supposedly learn from the mistakes of the league before them. So I got an opportunity. Again, the head coach had been at Clemson while I played there, Doug Shively. And when he got the job, he called me to move back on the offensive side and coach the running backs. And heck, I was gone like a bullet. We showed up on a Friday, all the coaches did, and we were in camp on Sunday. He was hired kind of late, but it was really a fun league. I hated that it didn't last any longer than it did, and I wasn't in it but 1 year because, that's when I really found out how this coaching stuff is business. Because after our first year at Arizona Wranglers, the owner of our team lived in California. The owner of the Chicago Blitz lived in Phoenix, where we were, and they just flopped teams. They ended up, our whole team went to be the Chicago Blitz, and the guy that owned the Chicago Blitz brought his team, and all of a sudden I was out of a job. So I said, man, you hear these talks, all these sayings about how this is a business. Well, we saw the business side pretty quick.
So in 1987, Coach, Frank Beamer was getting that Virginia Tech job at his alma mater, coming over from Murray State. And so just talk about how that all worked out for you to join Coach Beamer's initial staff there in Blacksburg.
Well, what actually happened was the spring before Coach Beamer got the job, again, I was at Northeast Louisiana, as it was back then, but I had actually worked with him a spring. And worked with their passing game some. And a friend of mine, my roommate from Clemson, was at Murray State. So I went and stayed with him and his wife and worked with them some that spring on their passing game. And so that, and I already knew who Coach Beamer was, him coaching at the Citadel, me being from Somerville. And he knew me, but, you know, we didn't know each other great. So, you know, working with him that spring, you know, he's a great guy to work with or work for. And he was actually trying to work something out so that I could stay there, because I was in between jobs at that particular moment. And I hadn't got to Louisiana yet. So he was trying to work out something by the end of spring for me to stay there, but didn't work out or whatever happened. I don't remember, but that's how we really got to know each other. And then I was at Louisiana, Northeast Louisiana, when he got the Virginia Tech job, and I was coaching the quarterbacks. And that's how we kind of ended up getting together in
87. Before we dive into your Virginia Tech experience, because like I've already mentioned, it was a lengthy one, those two different stints with a year at South Carolina, which we'll talk about in between in 94. We have an East Carolina fan chiming in, Johnny Gardner. You talked about your time in Greenville on Ed Emery's staff from 80 to 82, leaving right before the Pirates really did well with the 8-3 record in 1983. But he's asking if you had any good Ed Emery stories.
You know, your show don't last long enough. All this,
it's the family show, guys.
I understand. But I will say this. I mean, Ed was one heck of a hardworking recruiter, no matter what else went on. And he was a recruiter. And I learned something from him. And, you know, normal practice in recruiting is assistant coach gets the head coach to come into the prospect's home. So the head coach and assistant coach is there at the prospect's home, you know, just to kind of make conversation. But that's the one visit that a head coach gets. And Ed was so good with recruiting, he didn't want an assistant coach to be there. His thing was, and I'll never forget this, and I said this to my staff a few times and kind of laughed, but Ed always felt if two of us are in the same home, then one of us is wasting our time. And that's the way he felt about it. He had no problem in walking into a home that he didn't know, the athlete maybe didn't know the parents or the assistant coach had already done all that. And I found as I became a head coach, it didn't bother me to go in where I didn't know a parent or hadn't met their parents prior to coming in. So, but I always remember that was something that he truly believed in. If two of us are in there, one of us is wasting time.
Coach,
that's about as clean as I can get right now.
Coach, we're based in Eastern North Carolina, so
right. We've
had a chance to have a lot of different East Carolina players on. And funny enough, every player that played for Ed Emery mentions Coach Emery's wife. I cannot think of her name right now. I'm sure you remember, but the players loved her.
I think it was maybe Jan. I can't remember. She was awesome though.
Was it Nancy?
Yes.
Yeah, I think it was Nancy.
Yes, you're right. It was. But Nancy. But, Nancy was a sweet lady. She loved the players. The players loved her. And you know, Ed kind of out recruited himself on that one right there.
Regarding Coach Emery on the recruiting trail, here I guess 5 or 6 weeks ago now is right when everything was getting cranked up with the coronavirus back in mid-March.
Right.
We had Jody Schultz,
sure,
who was a second-round draft pick out of East Carolina by the Philadelphia Eagles, and he was telling us he was headed to Wake Forest, and I'm trying to remember the assistant coach's name. Coach Fast, maybe?
There was a Coach Fast on our staff.
Okay, Coach Fast came up there to Maryland recruiting him. Coach Emery said, do not come back unless you have Jody Schultz with you or committed.
Well, I've heard that statement before. There's a couple times I didn't come back.
Jody said coach came to his house three straight days. He didn't get worried. He didn't know what was going on.
Jody was a heck of a player for him. We were so glad. My recruiting area was over in the Winston-Salem, Greensboro. That was my area over there, and we had some really good players from over that area.
So, Coach, getting back to your time at Virginia Tech, I know, obviously, Coach Bill Dooley had a lot of success prior to Coach Beamer getting the job.
Right.
So, just talk about that challenge. I know your first – I mean, you had a couple of six-win seasons, and then I know in 92, I want to say you were 2-8-1, but then after that, right before you left to go to South Carolina and then came back the very next year, things really ascended, and the Hokies haven't missed a bowl since.
Exactly. When we got there, we were independent, and that was hard to do. We were playing anybody that we could play. We were, getting away from at that time, the 1AA type teams. I know one year we actually had a game supposed to be at our place against Florida State. And, we sold it or whatever you do and ended up playing down in Orlando, made a bunch of money doing it. But, that was the kind of where the program was at that time. I mean, you were just trying to survive. And we were playing a lot tougher schedule than Coach Dooley had played, and we were in that season where we went to 2-8-1 or whatever it was. Honestly, we didn't know if we was going to make it past that season. I think there was a decision made at one point there at the end to go one more year, and obviously we went that one year and went to the Independence Bowl, and the rest was history. But it was tough during that time, and I think the commitment to the program was good, but not near where it was, going to get to.
Coach, I had a question as far as, I know you're not in Blacksburg anymore, but do you have any friends that are still there? One of the things that's been very hurtful for both East Carolina and Virginia Tech is obviously the canceled series. I know there was a lot of problems with the hurricane a couple of years ago. I'm hoping that I love Virginia Tech, and I'm hoping at some point that just like Southern Miss, two schools that were independent for many years, I'm hoping that at some point we can get them back on the schedule.
Yeah, I mean, it was a great game. I mean, and we didn't win. I think I know they beat us at home one time, and we might have gotten the best several times. But that was just a short drive for everybody, and we recruited Virginia Beach as hard as anybody, and so did East Carolina. So I mean, there were kids on both teams that we had both recruited. It was just kind of no matter whether we played there or whether they came to our place. They brought a great crowd. And at that time, the stadium obviously was not as big as it is now. And we needed those crowds. But it was just a good little, I don't want to say rivalry game, but it was a good, tough game every time we played them.
And kind of piggybacking off what you're saying, Coach, during that first stint that you had in Blacksburg from 87 to 93, just as far as being close competitive games, I remember in 1990, you guys won a very close game in Greenville where the Pirates were driving, I think it was pretty early on or middle of the ball game, and had a fumbled exchange that set up a score for you guys. And then the very next year, you jumped on the Pirates early when we had the 11-win season and had a 2 or 3 touchdown lead. And we were able to come back and win that game with a big pick six in the second half. But just talk about those years and just Coach Beamer's philosophy as far – he always hear Beamer ball. You think about that defense, the special teams, and the running game.
Well, that was it. And I think, I have not forgot that one play that I think one of them you talked about when you had that pick six. I think it went about 99 or 100 if I remember right.
Yeah.
We had a check on the goal line, and I had a backup quarterback in because my starter got hurt in warm-ups. And I hadn't told him not to check it down there, and he checked it and flipped it right to him when they took it to the house. But, that's Coach Beamer's style of football. I mean, he was going to be solid in that kicking game, as everybody knows. He was going to have, when you got into the recruiting battles in the staff room, there were going to be a lot more defensive good players recruited. So, you know, we were having to always fight for some offensive guys, which we, you know, we would get ours, but, you know, we wanted to have a good running game. You know, it's gotten crazy nowadays with all the RPO stuff and stuff that people do. But at that time, you know, a good run, strong running game we had, and a good play action game off of that. And that's kind of what was, you put that together with Beamer Ball and Bud Nimmo on defense. And, so there were times I know calling plays, you know, I wasn't going to try to put our defense in a bad situation because I knew we'd get the ball back. It made a difference calling plays. And, we threw the ball pretty well. And I had some guys that were drafted with Jim Druckenmiller and different guys that were drafted high and so forth. But it was a true pro attacking.
You talk about that decision to leave Blacksburg and go to South Carolina, join Brad Scott's staff, and you had a heck of a quarterback when you were there with Steve Tannehill.
Yeah. Well, we came back from our Independence Bowl, and I'll be honest with you, I did not know Brad Scott, but our offense probably mirrored Florida State's offense more than anything, because I always looked at Florida State film and did not know that when we played them, you know, how you exchange film, Brad and them, they were always looking at our offense, and we were very similar. And obviously, you know, it was a big thing to consider. Was I was getting closer to home. My wife was getting closer to home. I didn't know, I'll be honest with you, I didn't know what was about to happen at Virginia Tech. It had always been a struggle. And we went down, you know, I ended up taking the job down there and actually, I think, won their first bowl victory, if I remember right. They had been to bowls, but hadn't won. Yep. And coaching Steve Tannehill was, initially quite a chore, as you know, I'm sure a lot of history about Steve. And I had to get him, all the coaches went recruiting when I first got there, and the head coach, our Brad, left me to tell Steve he had to get his hair cut. But that was my first duty. But ended up being, you know, Steve and I got very, very close, and I actually benched him during the season and put in a backup quarterback because Steve was still kind of, you know, high riding a little bit, but he was better. But went 2 weeks that way, and nothing really happened with the other quarterback. And Steve, I think, got to a breaking point, came in my office, and I said, if you'll do it like I try to teach you and quit acting all this other way and doing all this, I said, I'll make a change again, which I was ready to make a change anyway. But Steve came in there and did a heck of a job and completely changed the way he did things. And I was really proud of him for that.
Kind of along the lines of what you're saying, I certainly remember, like you're saying, as far as him being excitable and just so passionate and getting on the bench and swinging the towel and getting the crowd into it. I know that that year in 94, East Carolina and South Carolina had an absolute shootout. It was 56-42, and Tannehill, and that's what just lighten it up after the Pirates had gotten the early lead.
Right. Was Steve's good? He was a good quarterback, and you know it was amazing when I got. He had already played his freshman year when I got there, and I'll never forget. And I've used this many times talking to other coaches and trying to teach young players. I said I put him and Blake, and who Blake was a backup, on the board to kind of tell them, I want you to draw a couple coverages for me, and it was a 3-deep coverage, a 2-deep coverage. So I can, and I've always done this with my quarterbacks when I go to a new job or I got a freshman coming in and so forth, just to find out where they are at the time, you know, kind of where they are and their learning and so forth. And neither one could hardly draw up the coverages, the two coverages. And I was not doing it to embarrass them. But that did let me know where they were as far as teaching and learning. And it gave me a starting point. And again, I had to kind of ride Steve hard on some things and the little things. But, again, in the end, after that bowl game, I hated leaving Steve as much as I did South Carolina. That was tough. Steve, that was a hard relationship that had gotten really, really good.
So talk about, before we dive back into your time, your second stint with the Hokies, just talk about having the opportunity to be involved in that Clemson-South Carolina rivalry from the other side of the fence, yep. from the Gamecock perspective.
Yeah. They, I'll tell you, you know, we got ready to play the game, and, you know, I knew what kind of game I was getting into, and but I never forget, we had to play him at Death Valley, and we drove up the night before. I forget, we may have stayed in Greenville or something like that. And as we were at the motel, a couple hours before we were leaving, my wife came up, and we were out kind of in the lobby area, whatever. And she looked at me, and I said, I now realize I'm in here with the dadgum enemy. 'Cause this thing was getting crazy. And I knew, I knew what the game was like and all that stuff, but I now knew I was the enemy. And we got to the stadium, and before the game, I went out. Several people, old friends, old teammates, yelled to me and went over and spoke to a couple. But when them suckers came down that hill, I was on the wrong side. But I'll tell you what, we played well that day. And, you know, we got up on them and it was, and I actually came down, I think, right at the beginning of the fourth quarter. We had gotten up on him, and I told one of them big GAs, young GAs, I said, I want you to walk with me. And I ain't walking through all these people by myself. And they were calling me all kind of names at halftime, and they were so nice to me like an hour ago. And all of a sudden, it's halftime, and they're not so nice anymore. So that was I won't forget that one because I was in there with the enemy on that one.
Hey, kind of a funny story, right, quick about that, Coach, as far as the Clemson-South Carolina rivalry. My mom's cousin down in South Carolina, Aiken, he was a Gamecock. His wife was a Tiger.
Right.
So they were going to the game one year, and they said pulling into Clemson, they had cut a chicken's head off and hung it on the stoplight, and it was dripping blood down into their car.
Oh, my gosh. I'm going to tell you, there's big rivalries in this country. That one right there at the top of the list, I promise you.
So, Coach, go ahead, Dave.
I was just going to interject just one quick thing. The very fact that that rivalry is special because there's you've got those two schools have been the two biggest schools in the state for a long, long time.
Forever, so, yeah. I mean, I don't know how long the rivalry's been, but ever since the two were built, they've been playing each other and being nasty to each other, because in my family as well, I've got my family is probably more Clemson, but in my wife's family, got a little Clemson and Carolina, so we've had quite a few little things to say over the years.
Makes Thanksgiving very interesting, right?
Yeah, exactly, very interesting.
Coach, earlier on, you mentioned Jim Druckenmiller, obviously a tremendous quarterback in that 96 season when y'all went 10-2 and right. played in the Orange Bowl, I think it was, Orange or sure.
Yeah.
And so he went on to time with the 49ers. I think about some of the running backs you had during that year, Marcus Parker, and then also Oxendine.
Oxendine.
And then later on, when Mike Vick was there, and we'll talk about that in a minute as far as his recruitment and so forth,
right.
but Lee Thugs and Kevin Jones.
Yeah, we had some running backs now, and what you know, you talk about Beamer ball. What people don't know that year, Lee Thugs led the nation in touchdowns scored, but he also had blocked four punts. So you know where Coach was going to put the good people. You know, it wasn't about, and a lot of people don't know that. But he was number one in the country, but he was also on our first team punt block team. So that's the kind of people that you were going to use on that team. But, those guys, they were just – I mean, I think, they were big-time running backs. They were great, tough running backs. I don't know if you put them all, which one would outrun either one, but they all had good speed. But they ran the tough yards and made people miss. And, that's kind of, toughest we wanted behind that offensive line because that's where the offensive line was going to be.
All right, Coach, we have a question from one of our listeners, Johnny. He says, was Coach involved in recruiting Mike Vick to Virginia Tech primarily or secondary?
It was more secondary, but, you know, from the time we started recruiting, Jim Cavanaugh had that area. That wasn't my recruiting area, but I was going to go see any quarterback anytime, wherever it was. I was going to be involved in the quarterback, period. But in Mike's case, it was, you know, his coach, high school coach, Tommy Riemann, that was going to be a big part in recruiting Michael. You were going to have to go in there and see his high school coach, obviously see Michael. But I was going to, you know, again, be involved in recruiting a quarterback no matter. I did that every year. But in this case, I had to do probably make a few more trips over there than I did normally. My first trip over there, and I'll never forget this, it was a meeting between my first meeting between his high school head coach, Tommy Riemann, and myself, and Jim Cavanaugh, who was the assistant coach that had that area. He brought me into Coach Riemann's office. Coach Riemann was at his desk. I sat in a chair in front of his desk, and Jim grabs his big Coke that he always had and went over by the window and sat and was going to drink his Coke on the radiator. And it was just going to be me and his Coach Riemann for the next 2 hours. And, I mean, I got asked a lot of questions. I said a lot of things. Coach Riemann said a lot of things. But Coach Cavanaugh was not – he was not going to be a part of that talk or that visit right there. So he just sat there and looked out the window and got out of the way. And I sat there with Coach Riemann for several hours and answered all the questions that Coach Riemann had, all the possible situations that might come up with Coach, or whatever questions he had for every recruiter that came through there. But I was, you know, he was wanting to know more from me because I was going to be the position coach with Michael. And so, I'd actually had another young man at Virginia Tech that played for Coach Riemann that I think it was after 2 or 3 years, he decided not to play anymore. So it wasn't like a situation where, I mean, he got out of school. He was not going to go to school anymore, but I stayed in touch with the kid. I tried to get him to go back to school. I tried to get him some tryouts with some teams, and I kind of stayed after him about his books and academics. So he went to New River Community College, did that down in Roanoke, I believe. And I stayed with the kid, and Coach Riemann knew all about that. I had never dropped that kid once he quit. And I think that was something that I would have done for anybody, but in that particular case, it was a big deal to Coach Riemann that I had, when that kid quit playing, that I just didn't drop him and forget about him. So that was quite a meeting, though. That was quite a meeting for 2 hours.
So specifically about Michael Vick, obviously a very highly touted prospect, that goes without saying, but just with his athletic ability and everything he brought to the table, just talk about his development and kind of evolution as a quarterback.
Well, you know, again, like I said a while ago, when Michael came to Virginia Tech, after we recruited him, I got him on the board to kind of see what he knew and where he was. And I don't remember exactly, because again, you're talking about high school kids that come in, and Michael will tell you this: it was a tough year for him. I don't know how many people know this. I think this, I don't know if it was on his 30 to 30 show thing or not, but he almost quit because it was just so much going on.
Wow.
You know, for a freshman. And he had a camp here in Atlanta, I think 2 summers ago, I think it was. And he told this story to the kids out there that how he was really struggling his freshman year. And one day he said, I wanted him to travel with the team as a redshirt freshman, because I felt like that's always a new experience. I knew he was going to be the quarterback next year. There wasn't going to be any decisions on who the quarterback was going to be. And I didn't want that to be something new for him to, you know, all the traveling, all the meetings, all the things that go on, it kind of gets you out of whack a little bit. So I made him come to every meeting with my quarterbacks during that freshman year. He traveled with us. He went to every game. So he was getting that experience. But one day he came off the field really frustrated. And again, he's telling this story to the campers out there that I just told him, said, Mike, let's hit a knee. Let's sit down. So we sat there and I talked to him and basically told him, Mike, I know where you are right now. I know how frustrating it can be. I said, we're going to start back over in the spring and you'll be fine. And if you will trust me and you keep doing, you got to take care of your books and your academics. I said, if you trust me, I said, you will be fine. I said, you will make it to the NFL. I said, I've seen the talent that he had. The very first day we practiced, that was the first time I'd seen Michael throw up close. And we went in that indoor facility over there because of bad weather, whatever. And the first ball he threw was from the hash mark to outside the numbers through an outcut. And when I saw that ball, never got more than head high. It looked like just a beam. And I thought to myself, damn. That's exactly what I said. And I told him, I said, do that again. And sure enough, he dropped back, laced it over there again. I said, holy cow. But again, he was going to redshirt. And that was part of the deal with his high school coach. But he did. He was getting frustrated with not understanding everything. Like he told the camera, he said, all my buddies were staying on the weekends and, going out, having fun, doing all. And he said, they made me travel with the team. And I had to be with the team. And so, there was a lot of things for him. And then I think some situations back home. But he told those kids when I sat him down, he said, if he'll just trust me that it'll all work out, we'll take it a step at a time. And I said, you will play in the NFL. And that's the message he was giving those kids.
Coach, I had a question as far as one of the things I was impressed with. Is of course that 1999 season where Virginia Tech played Florida State and that national title game in the Sugar Bowl. I remember watching that game. I was working in radio in Elizabeth City that night, and I was just so excited to see. I've always liked Michael Vick, and obviously with East Carolina, Virginia Tech, the ties, it was like you have like a, I don't know, it's like a special player there for sure. Virginia Tech versus a giant like Florida State.
Well, yeah, I don't think it bothered Michael a bit. He handled so much that whole freshman year, and it really all began, as a snowball, a very small snowball. And as time went on, I talked to him about those things and what was going on. And, of course, when you started getting toward the end, there was some newscasters and so forth, ESPN guys putting together scenarios that we could be in the final game and national championship. And he really did a great job of just kind of, staying level with it. And that's what I've always preached to my guys is, you can't get too excited. You can be excited at the moment, but you can't be on the sideline and be a cheerleader. What's that?
Go ahead.
I said, you've got to be in the game. And that's why I always brought him off the field and would put him on the headset. And I wouldn't let him watch the game. Even if I'd tell him a joke or something, I wasn't going to let him go up there and get involved in the game and get unfocused. But he just he handled that so well for a freshman. It was incredible, the accolades and the Sports Illustrated's and all the things that went on with him. And he was one of the most he's probably the best quarterback I've ever coached, but he's one of the best young guys I've ever been around during that time.
Yeah, and you didn't see freshman quarterbacks in that kind of limelight in those days at all, ever. Since then, you've had, I guess it kind of started up with, in recent history, Jameis Winston and Johnny Football and on down the line. It's more common now. But at that time, have a freshman at quarterback to be that high profile, competing for a national championship, Heisman Trophy candidate, all that kind of stuff, it was really unheard of as a freshman.
Exactly. And, he really, I just can't say how well he handled all that because, man, the interviews and things that he had as the season went on, especially at the end. And he was changing. He is changing Virginia Tech football. We didn't really know it at the time, but he was changing Virginia Tech football. He was changing the way college football looked at quarterbacks, and here since has changed the way some of the NFL is looking at quarterbacks.
Yeah.
And but we at the time we didn't know that. You know, I'd run more zone read with him. You know, but I knew he was going to make plays anyway. But some of the things he did were just uncanny. And you know, you talk about that national championship game. I never saw that game on TV copy until back before last year sometime, because we always saw it on the videotape in the coach's room.
No.
So I actually, because I was going to be on that 30-30 show that he had back in November, I said, I'm going to sit down and watch that game, because I had it on my computer. And it was the whole thing done on TV, all the announcers and everything. And I kind of forgotten some of the stuff he did was crazy. I mean, I'm just telling you. You know, I mean, he did some things in that game, and there were two guys, Mickey Andrews told me after the game, two guys tried to tackle him, and they both tore their knees out, tore their ligaments in the knees trying to tackle him. But some of the things he did in that game, which I saw it always on a video, and I could run it back and forth, but this is when you're kind of caught up in the excitement of the game. Announcers are excited. They said, good golly, look at that. Look at him do this. You know, it was crazy.
So, Coach, you remained in Blacksburg through 2001. Just talk about your desire to become a head coach and just kind of, I mean, was that the first opportunity you had with Louisiana Lafayette, or maybe there have been others that you had turned down? And because obviously Coach Foster, who just retired and just stepped down and was in Blacksburg all those years, and you always heard, I mean, who are those hot commodities, and when's Bud Foster, what job is going to be good enough for him to leave? And he never did. So just talk about your situation.
And it's funny. Bud and I talked about that an awful lot when I was there too. But, you know, I had several opportunities. I'd gotten involved in several jobs the last few years. Had been offered one or two. I can't remember. Didn't take it at the time. And having coached in Louisiana maybe made that a little bit easier for me. I don't know. But I also had talked to some coaches in the business, and you know, I always wanted to learn from people, and I had several of the older coaches at the time say they wish they had just taken that shot, you know, that they could have maybe got one here or got something there, and they just didn't do it. And I always wanted to have a chance to do that. I'd been close on a couple things, and or at least got involved with several few things. And I did not want to, I guess, get out of this career without ever taking that shot. I unfortunately didn't take a great job, the one I took at the time, but I was very familiar with a lot of people down in that area and so forth. But that was kind of my thing, was as much as I love Virginia Tech, I mean, I could have stayed there forever myself. I loved working with Coach Beamer, and the staff was so good to work with. But I did not want to be that guy that always wanted to be a head coach that just didn't go out and take that shot.
Coach, we have a Raging Cajun tuned in on YouTube. Steven has a question or just a comment just saying Louisiana just had its first 10 and 11 win season in school history under Coach Billy Napier. Coach Bussell was the initial building block for our success today. Thanks, Coach. His teams are always exciting to watch.
Well, I appreciate that, Steven. We inherited kind of a blank slate. At the time that we got there, that they hadn't had any winning seasons in a while. And we had several, and we actually won the conference one year, or tied for the conference, should have won it, but we ended up tied for it. And, you know, I really do feel like we built some solid building blocks for that program to move on. We were really facility kind of choked. Our facilities were very bad, weren't very good. We tried to do a lot of things to make the fans, the supporters were awesome. They deserve to have a winning team. I'm so glad they had a big year. But I do think that, I think I was there 9 years, and I do think we built a very solid football program. You know, when I took it over after the first year, and we had that last meeting after the first season, and I let all the seniors leave, we were down to like 30 some scholarships. Wow. I mean, we just didn't have many scholarships. And how we recruited some of those guys that we did, you know, to our facilities and so forth was, you know, I just credit the guys that recruited them and what we were trying to do. But, you know, we were short on money. It was a mid-major. That whole conference was very similar. And what, you know, my saying was always, you know, I just don't want to build this thing for somebody else. And honestly, you know, I feel like I did build it. I think somebody else got to kind of reap the benefit. But that's a personal thing. I'm glad that they got the program got better, and I'm so glad they built the type of facilities that they have here now. And I know Billy. I know several guys on the staff that played for me, and I'm always texting Billy and texting a couple of the coaches. I'm pulling for them. But the fans are just, they're so awesome. They deserve that and really enjoy this because they've had a long, long, tough time.
Coach, I remember one game in particular. I'm going to jump ahead a little bit here, personal here. Back in, I think it was 06, you'll remember the year. You guys had a game against Houston. I guess it was at Houston, and they were pretty good that year. I believe it was 06. I want to say they won Conference USA that year. And I for whatever reason, had a hunch, and I was doing pick'em. In a pick'em group, and I picked you up with the upset, and y'all were the difference that week. And I always remember that game because people were like, "What, Lafayette over Houston? Got a hunch."
I do remember that game. We actually had our starting quarterback came in on some nickel blitzes. We were throwing everything at him, but and one of my good friends that had actually coached the secondary for us at Lafayette the year before was on that staff, and he actually came by after the game to congratulate our football team because he knew so many of the players. But I do remember that game. It was a heck of a game, and we threw everything we could out there and ended up we ran a fake punt for about 80 yards, and we were trying everything, I guess, but we played really well, and that was a good football team.
Coach, like you mentioned, during those years, I think you had 4 6-win seasons and really set up the following staff for a lot of success. And then Coach Napier's staff now, one of the things, just totally unrelated, but when I think of Louisiana, I think you talk about their fans, the tremendous atmosphere they have at their baseball games.
At all their games, all their sports. I tell you what, you need to go to one of the women's softball games one day. Half my football team was, of course, I don't blame them for that, but half of them were over there. Half of them were over there, you know, rooting and hollering over there with a softball. But they're based, you know, Tony Robichaud, who's now not with us anymore, but he did a great job with that baseball program.
What are your thoughts on the Sun Belt Conference as a whole? I don't know if you keep up with it now, but to me, the conference did a really good job during expansion, bringing up App State and Georgia Southern, two really good FCS or 1AA programs that have transitioned well into 1A football. I think instead of going after media markets like some other leagues did with CUSA bringing in Charlotte and some of the Florida schools,
right,
Sun Belt went and took the best teams they could, and I believe they've actually kind of elevated that league a little bit.
I don't think there's any question about that. When we first started that league, and that was, my second year, third year, you know, we were just trying to get whatever it was, 8 or 9 teams. And, you know, we had a couple teams in, and next year they were out. It was, you know, always kind of crazy. But I think it's a great conference. And when they added, and you're right, when they added Georgia Southern, Arkansas State, I think they added some status programs. And, you know, the TV package and all that they have with that conference now is very solid, and it gets, you know, them out in the – in the view on TV and everything. Because whenever we played, we had the TV kind of, we had to play whatever night we could get on TV. We might play on Monday night, Tuesday night, Wednesday night. Didn't matter to us. We just played. But I think they're actually making money now from those TV rights. So, but no, those programs that they added really gave it a shot in the arm. And I think having the same teams in there now for a while, it has helped too, because we were really shuttling some teams in and out.
And at one time, going back to the formation of that league, if I remember right, wasn't Louisiana Tech supposed to be a part of it and then ended up getting in the WAC?
You know, I don't know for sure. I thought they were going to get in, but they ended up going to the WAC, I think, a year before that was formed. But you're right. That would have been a great one right there.
Coach, after your time at Louisiana, I know you had the opportunity to, you spent a year at Tulane coaching the quarterbacks. Then you also spent a year in Hattiesburg on Ellis Johnson's staff coaching the running backs. And then after that, in a couple years as OC at North Carolina A&T. Talk about those stops at those CUSA programs, Tulane and Southern Miss.
Yeah, I really enjoyed Southern Miss. Bob Toledo was the head coach there. And he and I were kind of old timers, I guess, but we really hit it off. And I didn't work with him but just that 1 year. But Tulane was, again, they were kind of at a breaking point or a change. They ended up making a change with Bob after that year. And I think Bob had been there, I think it was his fourth year. But I really enjoyed the guys that I coached. But they didn't have it. You know, we played over in the Superdome, which was, it was neat to play in the Superdome, but it wasn't your stadium. So no matter how many people you had there, it didn't look like anybody was there. And now they have their own stadium and so forth. And then after that year, I went with Ellis over to Southern Miss. And that year wasn't a good year, but it was his first year. But obviously, you know, he had some issues with the interim AD and so forth. And it had to work out that they split ways. And but I did. I enjoyed it over there. I thought that was two really good programs. And there's been some great players. Heck, I met Ray Guy. I met Brett Favre over there at practice, watching his practice at Southern Miss and a lot of other guys. And they've done a nice job with commitment to the program and facilities and so forth. And then I got a call from Rod Broadway to come to A&T, which I did for 2 years. And, it was kind of I enjoyed my 2 years. I had a great time. That was as close as we had been home for quite a long time. That was a few hours away. But my wife was still trying to get a job, and she is Dr. Bustle. And I want to tell you, opposites do attract. Okay, she's we get mail at home. Her says Dr. Bustle, mine says Coach. So we opposites do attract. But you know, she didn't have a job right there, and I was starting to end up my career a little bit, and she got the opportunity to come here to UGA where she's working as the chair of the art ed department, and it was kind of my turn to follow her. So we did that, and so I've kind of been semi-retired being here. I tell all my players when they get me on Facebook and text me and stuff that, well, I said, I play golf in the morning, I coach a little ball in the afternoon, and my wife's working full-time at UGA. Cool gig.
Coach, I wanted to back to the Southern Miss thing with Coach Johnson the 1 year. Am I remembering this wrong? Did I make this up in my head? Were you going to be the OC there and then have some health issues and ended up being the coach? Okay. What happened to that?
No, I ran into some health issues right there. Those last couple of years, I think, Lafayette really took its toll on me. And, I was, and then going right into Tulane and kind of repeating that. And, I love Ellis and the staff to death, and I just didn't feel like when I got over there after I started again that I wasn't where I needed to be yet. And so, I went in and visited with him. We talked about it. It was an easy change, but it probably took a year or so, and just got me back to where I needed to be.
Coach, I know this is the guy that. Ken Matosh, he's tuned in out in Wichita, Kansas. And so he wanted me to tell you hello. And he said, you're a heck of a position coach and offensive coordinator. And he hopes you and the family are doing well. And then very quickly, one final question for you. Sure. One of our listeners, Mike Mullis, he chimed in and he wanted to know as far as a Michael Vick. He said, have you anyone with more arm talent than Michael Vick?
Honestly, I have not. I've had several. I had Bubby Brister when I coached him that went NFL, Stan Humphries in NFL, Will Fuhrer went NFL, Jim Druff. He had the best, the darnest arm I've ever seen. I just, that's the only way to put it. He had a rotation on a football that God gave him. I mean, it's just, that's, like I said, that first day he threw from the hash mark to the outside the numbers shocked me. I mean, I just tell you, I mean, it was just crazy, but no, I mean, he's got to, and he had a great ability to throw the deep ball. Not just far. He would put it on the money. Bubby Brister was that way. Other guys, you know, Jim and some other guys I had, you know, they worked at it. But Michael and Bubby Brister, I thought Bubby had the best deep ball timing wise and putting it on the money. But Michael was unbelievable with that too.
Coach, we certainly appreciate you being so generous with your time. We really appreciate it. We enjoyed the awesome stories. I know our viewers did as well of several folks.
Yes, we did.
I love these stories, but we'd certainly love to have you back on sometime during the season.
I appreciate you having me on. I know we've talked about it before, and I didn't. I've enjoyed talking with you guys, but I'm gonna tell you one quick one about Michael before I go, because I didn't tell you one on Michael. Do I have time?
Okay.
Do I have time?
Yeah, yes, sir.
Okay.
Good. Go ahead.
Michael's freshman year, first ball game. He's going to start for Virginia Tech. That back when they had the Black Coaches Association, it always opened up the beginning of the season with that game. We were going to play Georgia Tech, and we were the only game on in town. Lee Corso, everybody was there. Michael's first game. And right when they blew the whistle to the kickoff, the lightning started hitting everywhere. I'd never seen a lightning storm like that in my life. Well, of course, they got everybody out in the stands. Everybody went inside. The game's not being played. And it kind of finally got to kind of a drizzle. The storm calmed down. But I'd gone down to the press box there to see what was coming behind it. And it looked bad. And I get a phone call up in the press box. And the coach said, Coach, Michael wants to talk to you. Because I didn't go down. So I get on the phone, and Michael said, because I know he's wanting to play, man. I mean, he's wanting to play his first game. He tells me, or he asked me, he said, when are we going to play? I said, Michael, I said, right now the weather don't look good. And I said, it looks like a lot of bad lightning coming behind this storm. He told me, he said, well, it ain't going to hit me. I said, well, you might be right. It may not hit you because you're so quick, but it's going to hit a lot of other folks out here.
That's the infamous game that struck Lee Corso's rental car.
It did. Lightning bolt went right through it.
Wow.
Right through it.
That's funny, Kyle. I remember that well. That car exploding, but I had no idea that that was Lee Corso's rental car.
My wife being the artist that she is, drew Lee a shirt with a lightning bolt going down through it. And I gave it to him at the East Carolina game when we played over there 2 weeks later. And I think he showed it on air or something, but it sure did. I'll never forget Michael telling me that it ain't going to hit me. I said, well, it might not. But anyway, guys, I've enjoyed it. Let's do it again sometime.
Thank you so much, Coach. Have a great night. Enjoyed it very much.
Y'all stay safe. All right.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, Coach. From the great state of Georgia there in Athens, home of course, the Georgia Bulldogs, and we'll see how they do this year. I think now we've got very excited. Bubba, we've got two more guests. It's going to be action-packed. Two guys we think a lot of. Two great Pirates, right, Bubba?
Oh, yeah. I'm very excited to have with us a couple of characters. Welcome in East Carolina specialist, punter, Worth Gregory, and also on the golf course, as you see on the right on your screen there, Davis Plowman.
I'm finishing up. It's a little dark. Only got through 13. My phone's on 4%. I'm walking my car so I can get charged up.
All right.
I would expect
quick interviews at 4%.
Yeah, you know, it was a nice day out. Figured why not.
Hey guys, I told David that's okay. Worse used to carrying him anyway.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Once or twice.
Hearing all that Michael Vick talk has me hurting, man. That he could have been at ECU.
Hey, we had Girard. I know we didn't need Vick. He didn't. I can say what I want to say. most long new ties.
Dude, I am so lost right
hey,
now.
Hey, we messed that one up. People don't know about that one, but he wanted to go to ECU, man.
Yeah, he did.
Is that true?
He didn't want to have to sit behind David Garrard, though.
Yeah, no, but that wasn't even the thing, is that his mom, like, really wanted him to go there. I met a couple coaches that recruited him.
Oh, wow.
The ECU staff that recruited him, and his mom wanted him to go to ECU because she was afraid he would get into trouble at Virginia Tech being around some of the kids he grew up with out of high school. And he went on his official visit to ECU, and he wanted to commit. But the ECU staff told him that he wasn't allowed to play quarterback if he came to ECU. They told him he had to play DB.
Yeah, if you watch the Vic documentary on what you're saying, Worth, that certainly came to fruition as far as not necessarily coming to a head at Virginia Tech, but after he moved on from Blacksburg, he was still running with that wrong crowd and got himself in some issues with the Falcons.
Yeah, especially even as they didn't want his brother to go to Virginia Tech either for the same reasons, and his brother ended up getting kind of in the same trouble. So that's why his mom, she really wanted to get him out of Virginia, but that's a mistake you make in coaching. Like, definitely don't tell a massive athlete what position he's supposed to play till he gets on campus.
You guys remember, you talk about Marcus Vick. You guys remember the Citrus Bowl where he decided he was going to try to stomp on somebody's head?
Yeah, I remember that. That was a big deal. He would have been an absolute animal. See, even a guy like him would have benefited from not staying close to home or being close to the guys he grew up with.
So, guys, first of all, like we said, welcome to the show. We appreciate you coming on. I'm pretty sure we've had you on before, Worth. I know Davis, we talked to him, told some of the war stories, so to speak, reflecting on the time of the Pirate.
Oh, yeah.
And we'll go down that path here, I'm sure. But let's talk about what you have going on with one-on-one kicking.
So, me and Davis right now, we run – so one-on-one kicking is a big company, has a bunch of different divisions, but me and Davis run the one-on-one kicking North Carolina. So we're based out of Raleigh, North Carolina, but we will soon kind of be in Charlotte and on the East Coast of Wilmington as well. But we run a camp every 2 weeks in Raleigh where we have, before coronavirus, we had about 25 kids every weekend, helping them through kicking and punting, as well as kind of helping them through the recruiting trail, kind of helping them get noticed and go on into the next level like we were able to.
How is this affecting your business? I mean, how do you?
Oh, it's crushed it. I mean, to be honest, I mean, this is – so right now, this is – it's been my kind of full-time thing. But Davis as well, he works at Wells Fargo, so he has something else going on. But it's kind of crushed it. I mean, we were able to kind of do – we've done a couple one-on-ones in the last month, really, but nothing like we're supposed to. We stopped all of our payments and told all of our kids that we'd hit them up kind of mid-May was what we're kind of aiming for to restart everything up. So hopefully we're trying to aim for May 17th. We're going to have groups of 8 or 9 guys together, but I think that's kind of the max that we're aiming for at this point. But since the last couple months, we haven't been able to do anything.
You said May 17th?
That's what we're aiming for, really. We're hoping by then the restrictions are kind of just 10 people or less. We're kind of back to that, where we can do like 8 or 9 guys, maybe.
Right. That's what they're claiming, you know, phase one. So.
Yep, they're saying phase one, but shoot, Davis is – he's from Georgia, so he's wondering why they haven't opened up the whole country already. So.
He doesn't. That's not true. That's not totally true.
Totally true.
Now, we're,
I mean, I've been having to go to the office every day, so you know, it's not real. Davis, not a real big change for me.
Davis has made zero changes whatsoever.
Now, before we talk more about this venture with one-on-one kicking, let's talk. You had the opportunity to coach out at Utah State, very solid program. I believe you were there with the staff that's at Texas Tech now, if I recall correctly. And then obviously NC State as well.
Yeah, so I was lucky enough to coach for a team out of Utah State where we had the best season in the history of the school. You know, when you have a QB like Jordan Love, who just obviously is now going to be the replacement possibly for Aaron Rodgers, you can get things going. I mean, we had 5 senior O-linemen. We had we had nine guys that were seniors on offense that left after that year, which is why a guy like Jordan Love struggled his senior year. But it was really everything kind of came at once. I mean, Matt Wells, that staff at Texas Tech, did a really good job building the program. You had a point where you had a bunch of seniors. You had a point where the schedule wasn't crazy difficult at a conference, at least. And it kind of was a perfect storm for us. I mean, we were hitting at all cylinders, and even the bowl game where we had four coaches, because every coach had left to go to Texas Tech, we had four coaches for the bowl game. And I don't even know, like during the week, I don't even know how we corralled the team, because we couldn't even get the guys to show up on time there or anything. But we were still able to win by 60 just because the talent that we had was just absurd at Utah State that year. And then lucky enough, I was able to kind of parlay that job after everyone left at Tech to get the NC State gig and be close to home, where we had an awesome year special teams wise. We didn't win the games that we wanted to on the field, but our kicker and punter had two of the best years in school history. So awesome experience to be able to do that.
You know about Jordan Love, I remember first time I got to see him play, I want to say, was it against Michigan State a couple years ago? And
yep, that was our opening game was Michigan State, and we lost at the last second. We were driving the field for the win, and that defense end hit the ball out of his hand at the end. We lost.
Yeah,
that's we're winning most of the game.
Incredible performance. That kid was amazing.
Yeah, he's elite. I mean, people knocked him this past year and said he struggled at LSU and all that. But you got to remember, he had five completely new offensive linemen, and that's no new task. I mean, he lost a bunch of receivers, lost a massive X. When you lose your best, he was the only receiver we had over 6'4". So when you lose that deep threat, it really hurts you, especially when you don't have an offensive line. So that's why his senior year was a little down.
Kind of getting back to your time at NC State, Christopher Dunn, a tremendous place kicker. I'm a North Davidson guy. He's obviously a North Davidson guy as well. I was well aware of what Christopher Dunn could do, so I'm not surprised the success he's had with the Wolfpack. But just talk about coaching him.
He's a great kid. I mean, we always talk about how he's like – we would always say he was the blind Thor, because like he has all the power in the world for that program, and he doesn't even know it, because NC State, before he got there, the years before that, just really struggled with field goal kicking. So he was kind of like the savior for that program the last couple of years, being able to make some kicks. Outstanding kid. I mean, he's only going into his junior year, and he has a bunch of time left, and he's gonna believe in that program probably as one of the best kickers of all time. I mean, the only kicker I know that even compares to him is Nicholas Sadie or Mark Primanti from a long time back when he won the Groza. So Chris Dunn, probably one of the best mindsets of on the field kickers I've ever seen. He's just like Davis, just mentally, where he doesn't even understand the moment going on. Like he just feels like he's just kicking on a field by himself.
Kind of piggybacking off what you're saying as far as the Wolfpack struggles on the place kicking side of things. I remember a game in 2016 where some place kicks came into play a big time, and I know you remember that as well. I had to bring it up.
Yeah, even are you talking about which one? Are you talking about the Clemson one? Or are you talking about when they lost the ECU?
Yeah, I'm talking about the loss in Greenville.
The loss in Greenville. Oh my gosh, that was the worst game of my life. Oh my goodness, dude, it was like. Do you guys remember how hot it was? Wasn't it like 100-something degrees?
It was hot.
Dude, because so the last punt of the game, I just remember I had like a game-winning punt. Because we're up by like four or something like that. And they were rushing after me, and my whole leg cramped up like as I'm punting the ball, and it went like 20 yards. It was like the worst game of my career. So, but yeah, the only reason we win that game is because NC State decided not to scholarship a kicker the year before that. Like that's what it comes down to, which is nuts.
And something I want to ask you about. Sorry, Kyle.
At least it was a good moment. We got to beat State again.
Yeah, for real. They're not going to schedule them for a while. I don't even know when the next time they play is.
Playing Greenville in 22. Is that right?
22.
Yeah, 22 in Greenville.
22.
I mean, that'll be the culmination of this staff's kind of career then, you know what I'm saying? Like, by then, Coach Houston's going to have his seniors in place. He's going to be playing the in-state rival. That game is literally going to define possibly not only that season, but their time at ECU. You know, if they win, if they lose that game, you know, like you lose the whole fan base. You know what I'm saying?
We'll beat them.
Oh yeah, no question. I mean, by then everyone's going to be a senior. The QB is going to be a senior. Like, I think they're going to be absolutely rolling by then. Especially with these recruiting classes that they've signed are just ridiculous. It's got to show up on the field now.
Yeah, being able to recruit like that without having lag.
What'd you say?
Yeah. Nothing like lag.
You're good. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, as far as Houston's concerned, when you look at recruiting, has been phenomenal. I don't know, Worth, if you've seen it. They have such strong ties in like a 3 or 4 state radius, especially I don't know what's going on in South Carolina. We're getting, when you look at Clemson, you got South Carolina, you got college. I mean, there's all these colleges there, but especially those two. And we're getting a lot of great players out of South Carolina. I'm not complaining. South Carolina is a great football state. I love it.
Well, it's probably from his time at the Citadel.
Yeah, no question. I think it's a little bit of that, but also the interesting thing that you're seeing now is a school like Clemson used to sign a lot of South Carolina guys, and you're not seeing it much anymore. Look at who's Clemson signed even the last couple months is they went into North Carolina and they took some guys. I mean, shoot, even the best linebacker in the whole state of North Carolina, Caba, is going to University of South Carolina. He's going down south. So it's interesting to see some of these North Carolina players going to Clemson or South Carolina, which you usually hadn't seen until now. So I think it's opening up possibility for ECU to kind of move into South Carolina. Yeah.
Worth, you actually created a nice segue for me. I know with your YouTube channel, you've built a nice following there, a decent number of subscribers in a short time, putting some things on there, just building off your experience as a player and as a coach, and just talking about how guys can use their social media account, specifically Twitter, for their advantage. So talk about that.
Yeah, I think the biggest disconnect I see in recruiting for high school athletes in general is that they kind of think that they're either their clout and their huddle tape or their head coach is supposed to get them recruited, you know. And I've just the amount of effort that you have to put in as a player now, especially as a kicker and punter, is you got to do it all yourself. And it's awesome to see some of the guys – even there's a guy I help out right now in Georgia that kind of has used all the techniques that I've sent him, and we've worked a lot, and he's gone from nothing to got an offer yesterday by Tulane. So kids are just taking it into their own hands more than anything, because that's what got me recruited, and that's the sole reason I even played college football, is I spent a crazy amount of time on social media just messaging people.
One of the things I want to ask you, just drawing
Worth as far as –
sorry, go ahead, Dave.
And sorry, it's one of those nights. Worth, I was going to ask you, picking back off of that, as far as recruiting, how big of a difference is it even now from the time you were recruited to now? It seems like it's been light years.
Yeah, it's completely changed. I mean, I spent the majority of my recruiting, I spent messaging people on email or sending out DVDs, which is non-existent now. Now it's either maybe a USB, but everything is just, you can just text the coach everything, you know, like, shoot, my senior year, you didn't even text with coaches. Like you weren't even allowed to do that. They didn't push that law out till right after that. You could even, like, the texting laws and the call laws kind of changed. So everything's changed even from my perspective. And I'm sure in 4 years, it'll change all over again. And after that ruling today, it's going to just massively change everything.
Yeah, talk about that ruling. What are your thoughts on that? Players going to be able to be compensated for their likeness, you know, potentially be able to get sponsorships. I was trying to, you know, think about that for East Carolina versus some other schools, even some Power 5 schools like a Wake Forest, you know, where football maybe isn't that important at Winston-Salem, where it could be an advantage for us, man. If that law was, or that rule was in place now, you'd have Bolton Ailers advertising for every car dealership in Greenville.
No question. It's going to, I mean, it looks like it's going to happen soon. I mean, he's going to be doing that in probably 2 months, you know. And what's crazy is I think as much as they're going to try to hide some of this stuff, I think it's all going to get leaked out how much the players are going to make off some of these deals. And once that happens, you're going to see recruits start choosing markets that they can make more money in. Like, if you're a kid now, like, why would you go to why would you ever choose Florida State over Miami now?
Well, you say that, but the folks in Tallahassee care a whole hell of a lot more about Florida State football than the people in Miami. Miami's
they
got
do.
Dolphins.
They
care about the Dolphins and the Marlins and all kinds of other stuff. Well, Florida State's the only show in town.
Yeah, but the only show in town will only get you the quarterback and probably like a dude on defense. Miami has enough. They have enough businesses. I think where more small time players will be able to be pushed.
Maybe.
Another thing to add, guys, with that is the fact that Florida State is not the Florida State we grew up with. It is a completely different animal. It's a big question mark right now. I know, I'm just saying, but what to add to his point as far as Miami, I mean, you've got the scenery down there with South Beach. You got a lot of like great atmosphere. Plus, there's that market is huge for car dealerships. And what if a coach does like turn that around big time? I mean, that would be all of a sudden you could have guys making $50,000-$100,000 off or more off of endorsements. Who knows?
Why would a player come to Greenville then when he could go to Raleigh? And then I guess we just shot ourselves in the foot then.
A little bit, no question. I mean, but it depends on the position. Like if you're a quarterback, you're going to go to the biggest market or the one that you can play. But at ECU, you're going to have five or six guys make a decent amount of money off this. Like at our time, like Shane Carden and Justin Hardy would have killed it. But would me or Davis made any money? Like maybe Davis gets sponsored by some golf company. Like that's really it though. Like nothing much. I think the small fish won't get as many as people think unless they're just doing it on social media.
My point is, though, Worth, you're in business. Are you going to advertise for somebody something that somebody don't care about? I mean, if nobody in Miami outside of a small group of people, truth be told, really give a damn about Miami Hurricanes football, why are you going to waste your money advertising with them?
It just depends on the clout of the guy, you know. Like, imagine, like, no one outside of College Station cared about Texas A&M, but Johnny Manziel, if he saw this right now, would be making a mil a year. Like, no question.
Oh, yeah.
If Johnny Manziel saw this right now,
that's a whole other animal.
And he needed to because he's not making money.
Dude, Tim Tebow would have made millions if he was in college right now.
Are they going to put a cap on it? Are they going to put a cap?
They can't.
Oh, my God.
They can't. I mean, it's ridiculous that they even had this law. The fact everyone always goes back to the argument that makes the most sense, and it's can a college student sell a piece of artwork that he makes? Like, it's the same thing. I mean, why can't you promote your own name? It's been ridiculous that it even was ever a law in the first place.
Now, I heard, and maybe one of you guys read it better than I did, but you're not going to be able to use the university's name when you're advertising. Is that right?
No, not at all. I don't think so.
Okay.
Yeah. Kyle, you heard correctly on that. You cannot have the university's name or I'm pretty sure that you're not even supposed to have, like, university colors.
Yeah, and that's why, and I'm not trying to be argumentative, that's why I go back to, you know, somebody advertising in a market, this player, nobody's
going to know.
Right. I mean, if they can't say, hey, I'm the free safety for the Miami Hurricanes, I mean, you know, whereas everybody, look, if you're a football player in Greenville or you know, Tallahassee, everybody knows who you are.
Yeah, no question. Yeah, that does kind of change it. You're right. If you can't use the university, then it really switches it up.
One of the things I wanted to ask you earlier when one of the others were chiming in, Worth, is just the parallels you often hear between kicking and golfing, oddly enough, you know, with for Davis being on the golf course. But just talk about that and just with what you guys do. Talk about coaching the mental aspect of kicking and just that lonely feeling that kickers can often have.
Yeah, I mean, I would say kicking is a lot like golfing. Punting is kind of nothing like it. So it's its own beast. They're two different things, really, especially in my head. But yeah, kicking, working the mental aspect is more than anything, being able to constantly, but it kind of just goes back to repetitions for us. Like if a kid has a crazy amount of reps, they usually don't get as nervous. The kids that get nervous in front of the massive crowds, usually the guys that just haven't done it enough or haven't spent the time doing it. So really finding that was my biggest issue in college is when you're recruiting kids, you got to find the one that's mental tough. So you got to get them to kick live in front of you and your staff. So I always think about there's a kicker I know who went to an Ohio State camp to kick it, and he was kicking in front of Urban Meyer. So he was absolutely crushing the ball. Urban Meyer starts standing beside him. He starts missing a lot of kicks, and Urban goes, "Why are you missing a lot of kicks? Like why?" And the kid goes, "I don't know. I'm just nervous whenever you're standing beside me." And Urban Meyer looks at the kid and he goes, "Well, that's really going to be an issue because I'm going to be there every game day." So like you gotta be used to having the head coach stand beside you. So, I mean, me and Davis had to deal with it. We had Ruffin McNeil stand beside us all of practice every single second. I can remember there was some punts.
Remember Jamie Land?
Yes, dude. There was some kids that just struggled. We had a kid named Jamie that's one of our best friends. He struggled live when the coaches, like, they knew they were watching him. So
practice All-American.
Practice All-Americans, yeah, or the sticks All-Americans for kickers. They do well off sticks, but there was some day, like, I don't know how many times I had to deal with Coach Ruff messing with me live. Like, after I cut my hair off, he used to, like, flick me off when I was punting at practice. Like he was always on you. Cause he knew, like, I would rather have 100 million people watching me punt than Ruffin McNeil standing beside me.
But worse, I always heard Ruff was just so nice and hugged everybody all the time. He wasn't fucking practice. Can't be true.
Dude, he was the funniest dude in probably the best coach I've ever had in my whole life. Like, without him, like, I don't even know how, like I never would have went to ECU without that dude. He was the reason I went there, and I'm so happy I did it. Like. But he really hate when I cut my hair before the bowl game at the Birmingham Bowl. And he wouldn't talk to me for like 2 weeks when I cut it. He was so mad.
Mess with the mojo.
Yeah, I know. He said I was Thor. And of course we lost that game too, so.
Go ahead, Dave.
Hey, what are your stories about as being a former player? Do you have stories about Ruff that obviously we're any PG stories or stories you can tell us here on the show?
Dude, there was just – Ruff is a different – he's a different animal, man. I mean, I saw him about 4 months ago in Raleigh, and he's the same guy. Just hasn't changed at all, and that's what I love about him. But he's one of the few coaches in college football. Coach Doran always did it when I was coaching State, but he would sit in every single special teams meeting in the front row. And he would always be either paying attention or he would stand up and he would cuss out a kid if they weren't paying attention. You know, he was all over every aspect. I've never seen a coach be able to hug any player on the team and know his parents' name 3 years into his stat. Like my senior year, he'd hug me and ask me how my mom was doing. Like that's not normal in college football anymore in general. And it's just wild, like, that we were able to have a coach like that.
Yeah, Coach Ruff was on with us the other night, and we actually asked him, you know, about his early coaching career, and he mentioned meeting Coach Robinson, Eddie Robinson, and and he said that, you know, he asked him for one piece of advice at a coach's clinic when he was a young coach, and he said never neglect special teams, and he said it stuck with him his whole career.
Yeah, A-Rob, man, he's a legend. We had him. I remember talking to him before the Temple game. It's weird that I just think about random things like that, but I remember talking to A-Rob right before the Temple game. Like, what a legendary North Carolina coach, too.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about a moment ago when you were talking about Urban Meyer made me think about, obviously, your redshirt freshman year. You were down in Alabama, had the opportunity to get a ring there with Crimson Tide. And so what would Coach Saban do to put pressure on kickers?
Dude, there wasn't much that he needed to do. I mean, if he's just standing beside the kicker, that's really it. It's wild. The last 2 years they've struggled with kickers. I mean, it's the problem with Alabama with kickers and punters, and even people told me this when I decided to leave, is that they're always going to struggle a little bit in that regard, because it's just the way that it's built the program. I mean, if they go scholarship a kicker, he has basically one kick in a game to miss. If you miss, they're going to go scholarship another kid. And when you have that mentality as a kicker and you know if I miss, I'm never going to play here again, it's pretty hard to consistently get better and be able to trust yourself, you know? And that's why they've struggled at that position. They need to kind of give a leash to some of these guys and tell them that they're all in on a guy for him to be able to consistently produce for them. We saw that even at NC State, like you got to give, like when we had our first year punter this year, you got to tell him like, hey, like no matter what, you're a punter, like whether you do bad or you do well, even if you're in your head, you tell him like, hey, if he shanks the first two punts for pulling him, like he needs to feel and know that he has an opportunity, and if he doesn't shank it, he isn't just below it, you know. But that's why Alabama's struggle is just bad with kickers. Is they're on just such a small leash.
So, guys, tell our viewers, promote your business a little bit. Tell them where they can find you online, be it Twitter or your website, and how they can get in touch with you guys to take advantage of your services.
Yeah, no doubt. So anytime you want to reach out to us, just onekickingcamps.com is really – that's the best way. And you just click train in Raleigh, and you can get a free training session and reach out to us that way. Me and Davis are both on social media. It's just at Worth.
I would say Worth is 100 times better on social media than me. You have more outreach. I am horrible at it. I never get on it. Honestly, I struggle.
He's also better on podcasts than you, David.
I've been, phone was dead. I've had a lot of technical issues.
Technical issues. This dude's been on the golf course since like 10 a.m. But,
No. I went after work. All right.
So if you want to hit us up, really just reach out to me. It's just at Worth Gregory on basically every social media possible. You can even hit me up on TikTok. It don't matter. Like there's any, I'm on every single platform. Just my name. It's pretty easy to find. So any questions about recruiting, anything, I'll basically hit up anyone that hits me.
I know we have our one-on-one kicking, Twitter pages, Instagram.
Yeah, man. But it's easy if they just go through that and they can just see it. But
what do you do on TikTok? Little short kick videos?
Because I just put
my wife's on TikTok all the time, and all I hear is nonsense. So
that was above me. I don't have any of that.
I just put videos of the guys that we kick with, because I mean it's just a constant feed of just like it just replays the video all over and over again like Vine. So yeah, it's like, actually pretty consistent. Like if you want to put like a kid kicking a field goal, like form stuff, like it'll just loop. So that's why I kind of like it. So I usually just put it on TikTok and then link it through Instagram, because I might as well. I mean, shoot, that's why I told Davis, he gave me crap for having TikTok. And I was like, if we're aiming to help out 12 to 18 year old kids, where is their attention at? And it's all of it is on TikTok. So
also 37 year old female teachers also enjoy TikTok. Not Facebook.
For real. Everyone is on. Shoot, it's crazy that that's the most used platform in like the history of social media now, like already. Like that's crazy. Like, and it's all because a million girls started making dancing moves on it. Like,
oh, I didn't know about that. Thank you for that.
It's massive. It's because you can post one video and get famous. It's just, it shows it to people you don't know.
Well, famous is a relative
term. I mean, famous is a relative term, but they got a girl on there that makes...
Are you getting paid? Do they get paid?
Davis, there's a girl that makes $13 million a month on there.
Oh, yeah, you get paid.
No way. No way.
Dude, she has like 100 million followers.
We have
13 million a month is absurd. Absolutely. No way.
Bubba, who's the former East Carolina
65K player? Video.
Will the dude's brother, and he's his brother.
Greer. Nash Greer.
Nash Greer.
Yeah, he kills it.
Will Greer's brother. Nash Greer was a Vine and YouTube, celebrity making millions of dollars.
Oh yeah. I mean, I know a guy there's a guy I know that has a YouTube channel. He used to kick at UCF. He makes close to a mil a year off his YouTube channel right now. He has 2 million subscribers. So, and that doesn't even include
YouTube makes a lot of money, but it's all the ads.
Well, yeah, it's all the ads. But the reason TikTok makes so much money is because they're about to use their ads as well. Like that Charlie DeMeo chick or whatever. She has like 65 million followers. Like,
I've never even heard of that person.
Well, if you think about somebody that's got 65 million followers, if you can just get them to wear your brand in the video, that's 65 million cat viewers that are going to see that brand.
No question.
Must be nice. Worse, get us TikTok famous.
We have a solid 100 followers, Davis. I don't think we're there yet.
Do we?
we have 100, yes, on the dot.
Oh, we'll see if you can get. We'll see if we can at least get you to 101.
Yeah, but I'll just do a million different podcasts. Just ask for one follower.
There you go.
Awesome.
You guys, we got anything else for him?
Yeah, any questions, man, even if they're just ridiculous, man, hit me with them.
Before we Dave, right quick, before we wrap things up, let's take a trip down memory lane, and we've already done that a little bit as far as some of their stories about Ruff, but what are your top memories of being a Pirate, whether it's a favorite game or, you know, a favorite aspect of the game day besides the game itself, whatever?
You know, if, I mean, are we talking about just straight ECU football game day, or are we talking about just ECU in general?
Either one, or both, sure.
Dude, I mean, me and Davis are going to tell you our favorite memory is probably Pantana Bob's is probably number one.
Yeah, that was a fun one.
I mean, yeah, dude, there's
a couple times a week, that was a fun one.
Yeah, more than a couple. But just sitting on that back porch, like, just, I mean, that's what we miss about ECU more than anything. But
Penny Draft.
Yeah, Penny Draft on Tuesday. Dude, that was so much fun. I mean, even Mug Night. But,
can't beat it.
Dude, yeah, ECU was just the time of our lives, man. We had so much fun. I mean, call it game day there, especially, shoot, our sophomore year is one that we'll never forget. We're packed out. We're winning every single game. We're dropping 70 on UNC. I'll never forget that. Those are some awesome, awesome memories. Beating Virginia Tech in the rain. James Summer scoring that touchdown. Dude, that was awesome. Because luckily, whenever it gets really muddy, it makes it really easy to stop a football. So, for some reason, I had like four punts inside the 20. That would not because of me. It was solely because it just like stopped in the mud. So we got a bunch down inside like the 10. So it was awesome game. Lot of amazing memories. I mean, the stuff about a college athlete, the crazy thing is you really miss you and the little small stuff. Like the biggest thing that I always remember is we had a 5 a.m. lift after the day after Halloween. And people that don't know, go to ECU don't know, understand how crazy Halloween is. So Jeff Connors had a mandatory 5 a.m. lift the day after Halloween, and we slept in the locker room. We went straight from downtown, slept in the locker room. The whole team did. So imagine we had like 55 kids in there after going out all night trying to lift. And it was just an absolute nightmare. Like, it was the funniest experience. But, like, those are some of the things that you just don't forget, like, just kind of stick with you. Or even one of the memories that Davis has definitely is, I've heard this one a million times, is when you guys, when they were getting ready for the St. Petersburg Bowl, Davis, and you guys almost broke the $1 million chandelier.
Oh, yeah. That happened.
Yeah, Shane Carden, they were doing the walkthrough for the Hail Mary play. And
yeah, it is a little too high, scrapes one of them. Everybody's like, oh, no.
It, like, scrapes, like, $1 million chandelier and, like, goes back and forth. And, like, apparently, like, Lincoln Riley about, like absolutely fainted watching that. And then we ended the walkthrough, like, right after.
Wow.
Yeah, I forgot about that one. But so many – you miss the little stuff like that. You know, like, you never forget the little things.
Well, there was a chandelier – In the stadium at the ball
this was at the hotel that we were staying at,
a pregame walkthrough.
Oh.
And they told him not to throw every throw, and he didn't throw any of them, but he decided to throw the Hail Mary one and almost hit
it. they tossed it. It's a little high, and everybody just holds their breath as soon as he lets go. Everybody's just like, oh no.
You guys like in a ballroom practicing?
They were
a walkthrough.
Times, Kyle. I'm sorry, guys, to interrupt. I played small college football, and there were times that we had those walkthroughs for whatever reason in ballrooms, like your ballroom. So I remember nothing that crazy, but I remember stuff happening.
We either do them in ballrooms or we do it in like the parking lot sometimes. I mean, you just choose random places.
Yeah.
Okay. There's so many funny moments of those because you can't talk if you're not in. You can't laugh. Most of the time, me and Davis are playing like outside linebacker, like as a scout team. Like, there's so many. Yeah, Davis doesn't know like a crazy amount about like positions on like defense and stuff like that, or like,
no, I don't
like
know
terminology. So like, Lincoln would tell him to like one of our OC would like tell him to rush or like do something, like show this stunt, and he would just like stare at him. We'd get yelled at, but like.
One of the linemen one time, I think it was Pitbull. One time, like, I had to blitz the corner, and he just stuck his paw through my chest. I thought I cracked my sternum in a walkthrough.
I remember Kurt Benkert dropping back for a pass, and we were holding the bags, and you gotta like hold them up whenever they throw it. And me or you like hit the ball down, and we just got absolutely obliterated by Coach Nickel. Like,
yeah, we just kept playing that game. We try to hit the ball down.
Yeah, because if you're a punter or a kicker, you gotta be like the scout. You gotta be like the scout team at all times. Yeah. Like if they need bodies, like you're getting called over.
Yeah, it's funny you bring that up, Worth. I remember I had a coach. And he said, "How do you expect us to get anything done when you won't let him throw the dang ball?"
Dude, yeah.
I'm what trying to be scout team hero.
Scout team All-American. Yeah, man. My junior year, I used to run down on scout kickoff. I used to love doing that. And Kirk Dahl would get so mad at me because if I like blew up my leg, Davis was our starting punter. So he used to always get mad at me for running down on scout kickoff.
All right, guys.
We certainly appreciate the time.
Thank you so much for coming along, Worth, David.
Yeah, no question. Anytime you guys need anything, reach out.
Thanks. Great. Thank you guys so much.
Yeah, absolutely. Anytime.
Yeah, appreciate you guys having us on. Sorry I've been all over the place.
it's okay, Davis. We know where we fall in the total.
I was on the golf course, haven't eaten all day, had to go drive through phone died, technical issues. That's my bad.
Davis, you got to fix this eating schedule, man. You go through this thing. He goes through this
dude,
thing.
Dude, I was so busy at work.
He eats like a bag of nuts today.
I was so busy at work, dude, I didn't have time to eat, and I thought I was going to get something at the clubhouse before I played. Clubhouse was closed, of course. Hey, so Davis, then I walked 13 holes and didn't eat, and now I just got some food.
That would be Davis. If me and him were in college, we would be sponsored by Moe's because they used to hook us up, the Greenville Moe's.
Yeah.
Shout out. They used to give us free burritos, but that's really it. NCAA violation, no question. That'd be our only sponsorship. Thank you guys again for having us on. Anything you guys need, let us know.
All right. Thanks, you guys.
Yeah, absolutely, guys. All right, have a great night.
Hey, you too.
Hi.
I'm here. Right. That was so amazing, guys, to have them on. And I was having Coach on earlier in the show. And by the way, folks, want to remind you that we've got a couple big events coming up. Of course, our usual Friday night trivia. That's going to be fun. We'll have the legendary Mike Ray, the legendary Mike Ray. He's going to be with us. And his show is Talking Racing with Mike Ray. We do that on Monday's normal podcast. But anyway, we have him, Bubba, and then Sunday is going to be very special.
Absolutely. Sunday, we'll take a look back at the 95 Liberty Bowl when East Carolina defeated Stanford 19-13. Chad Holcomb knocked in 4 field goals, had a heck of a day. Then Darren Hart had to pick 6. Darren Hart will join us. Hopefully, Chad Holcomb will join us. And then also Mark Libiano and also Emac, a tremendous cornerback who went on 10 years in the league. Those guys will join us on Sunday. So that's going to be a lot of fun, like with the Texas Tech rewatch.
It will be a lot of fun. And by the way, folks, if you have maybe a game that you would like to see for the watch party, you can simply just email our show, thesportsobj@gmail.com, thesportsobj@gmail.com. If you have maybe a guest, maybe if there's some trivia questions you want to participate, send, you can do that as well. But anyway, thank you guys so much. Appreciate you, Bubba. Thank you, Kyle, very, very much. We'll see you on Friday night at 7 o'clock right here on Facebook Live and the YouTube channel. Good night, everybody. Go Pirates!
You've been listening to the Sports Objective Podcast. Join us next time as the guys will be objective, and the objective is sports.